episode of the Hope Eliminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Dolly Smith-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful you're here. Today, I am joined by a dear friend and colleague, Stan Collins from San Diego, California. And you're in for a treat because we're talking about a hot topic today, which is about how we talk about suicide with our youth and our teens. I know there are a lot of parents and teachers and community members that have big questions around this. And so we're going to be digging in deep into what the best strategies are for doing this. And there's a lot of reasons why this is top of mind. I think we just embarked on a second season of 13 Reasons Why, and I can tell you that the people in my world are very concerned by this series. Initially, maybe we were encouraged by the fact that it opened the doors for some important conversations teens were having around things that they're struggling with. But in the end, we were very concerned about how the initial premise of the whole series was really romanticizing suicide and a number of other unsafe practices in terms of messaging that came throughout the series. So we're going to link to that today and why we can do better. We can do better in modeling for our teens how we talk about this. I think also recently we've been seeing a lot of news stories covering celebrity suicides and some very concerning reports coming out of national organizations like the CDC. And this is also concerning for those of us that are focused very much on how we message around suicide, because the constant drum of death data tends to make people feel very hopeless and helpless about the situation. So if we look to the Suicide Prevention Resource Center and the Action Alliance, the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention, we see some better suggestions on how we can frame our messaging around suicide that's intentional and strategic and really have a far more greater likelihood of having a positive outcome. And there's three basic things that we want to think about when we're creating messages around suicide prevention. Number one, is our message hopeful? Does the message increase an idea that suicide is preventable, or does it kind of perpetuate the myth that there's nothing that can be done? So that's one. Does it engender hope? Number two, does it celebrate life? Does it celebrate resilience and healing and journeys through recovery? And does it celebrate compassion and empathy? Or does it instead romanticize death or sensationalize a voyeuristic narrative about suicide where we're just kind of peering into someone's trauma? And then the third thing is, does it inspire action? Whether that's reaching out to resources or reaching out to one another, do those messages kind of kick off action steps that people can engage in, or does it kind of perpetuate stigmatizing myths and information that lead to inaction? So these are some of the things that we are going to be digging into today. How do we do this kind of stuff, especially with our youth, where maybe it's a little bit more nuanced and maybe a little bit more scary for some of us? So my guest today, this is where he lives and breathes most of his time. Stan Collins and I first met through his work with a program called Directing Change, where he encourages young filmmakers to create these 30-second PSAs that are really focused on the kinds of positive messaging that I just mentioned. This program's awesome. It's all throughout the state of California as part of the Each Mind Matters organization, and you're scaling nationally, which is always an exciting endeavor. He and I have also served on the founding board of United Suicide Survivors International, and I really treasure his input in getting that organization up and running. And we also served together on the Consumer Survivor Committee of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, where we help share the voices and perspectives of lived experience with our country's hotline for suicide prevention. In addition, Stan's not very old, but he's been in this work for a long time, and you'll hear why He's been in it for almost two decades, and he's presented over 750,000 adults and youth. That's a lot to keep track of over all these years. That's a lot of people. And not just youth. He's also presenting to the military and law enforcement. He's got a big heart for the first responder community, medical professionals, and so forth. And he's done his part in advocacy, all the way dating back to 2001, where he testified before a U.S. Senate subcommittee on the topic of youth suicide. So he currently is working all throughout California on a number of different initiatives and stretching himself a little bit more nationally to work on some suicide prevention curriculum and strategies. So it's my honor and pleasure to introduce my friend Stan Collins. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sally. It's great to hear from you again.
Yes, really great. Thanks for making time for us today in this very timely topic. So as I always do with the guests on the show, I'd really love for you to go back those 20 years and as difficult as it may be, just tell us that really important backstory of how you as a young person got personally connected to this issue and how you became inspired to be one of our nation's leaders around this topic.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity. So I have a saying that goes, when you speak the name of the beast, it will retreat. And the beast in this story is obviously suicide. And that's really, I was thrust into this, as you said, at a very young age. So I grew up in San Diego, California. And growing up, I had a good friend of mine that I had met through my brother. My older brother and his older brother were best friends. And so whenever, since they were 4 years older, they could drive. So me and my friend Jesse kind of had this arranged friendship where our moms would throw us in the back seat, and whenever they were going to the beach or the movies, we tagged along. And, you know, me and Jesse honestly would not have been friends if it weren't for our brothers. We were very different people. I was a, you know, self-proclaimed nerd. I was 100 pounds dripping wet, and Jesse was he was the other end of the spectrum. He was kind of a skater, ran with a rougher crowd, but he was a year older than me, so I just idolized him. I thought he had the whole world figured out. And I was really lucky my freshman year of high school because me and him ended up in the same fourth period geometry class. So every day our classes or our desks were right next to each other. So every day I could look forward to going to him. He was my saving grace. If I can make it till fourth period, I can survive the day and everything's going to be good. And so over the months we got to be really close and, you know, he took me under his wing. But one night I was coming home from practice and I was walking down the hallway of my house and my older brother was coming towards me. And as he got closer, I realized he had tears in his eyes. And my older brother has gone on to be a law enforcement officer following the footsteps of my mother and my father. And so me and him are at very different ends of the emotional spectrum. So for him to see him crying, I knew something was going on. I'm the other way. Like I cry at Disney movies and Hallmark cards, but for me to see my brother with tears in his eyes, it was one of those moments where it's like the powers that be have pressed the pause button, you know, and everything slowed to a crawl. And it was one of those moments in life, and I'm sure I know for a fact that you've had these where it's like there, you know there's a fork in the road and you know there, you have absolutely no control over it. And so I went up to my brother and I asked him what was going on. And I'll never forget how he said it and the words he used when he told me that Jesse had died by suicide. And, you know, here I was, a 14-year-old boy standing in the hallway with my brother, and the weight of those words just hit me like a million pounds. And I remember stumbling back and sliding down and just putting my head between my knees and just crying for hours, just being so overwhelmed with, well, as a survivor, you know, all the emotions from confusion, anger, guilt, shame, you know. And it's for those who have lost somebody to suicide, you know, that it's, you can't even hold on to one emotion long enough to process it before the other one punches you in the face. And so there I was, waking up the next morning trying to figure out my next step. And so, you know, I just got ready and went to school. And, you know, my mom said, oh, you don't have to go to school. You can take some days off. But for whatever reason, I just felt, no, I got to go to school. And so I went to school and I couldn't understand why until I walked into my fourth period geometry class. And I realized that there was still a piece of me at that time that was, you know, that was hoping this was all going to be a bad dream, that I was going to walk in and Jesse was going to be there and you could move on. And instead what happened was that day and every day for the rest of the year, I ended up sitting next to his empty desk. And every day I sat there for 50 minutes in geometry. And instead of learning, I sat there wondering, you know, what I could have said. What if I would have stopped by? I had seen him just a few hours before in geometry class, before I got the news from my brother. You know, if I was such a good friend, why didn't I know this was coming? Why didn't you know, my parents and my teachers talked to me about sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all the ways that teenagers can die. Why didn't anybody ever talk to me about this? And, you know, this was back in the mid-90s, but it was the dark ages as far as suicide was concerned. And so that's what I was met with, was just silence, you know, just complete and utter silence. Nobody reaching out, nobody offering support. It was just overwhelming at that age.
Wow. Yeah, that survivor guilt can be incredibly powerful, and especially if you don't have any, you know, models around you to help through it or process it. What happened next?
Well, that's kind of where it was, and it was left like that for a few years, that just that silence and nobody really talking about it, nobody doing anything about it. And then my senior year, going into my senior year of high school, my father, who I mentioned is a law enforcement officer, he was on something called the Suicide Homicide Audit Committee, where they were going back and they were reviewing youth suicides. And he had come across this program called the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program, which actually was founded out where you're from, outside of Denver, Colorado. Right. And he asked me to come to this presentation, and I sat in on the presentation, and, you know, I walked away from it just feeling really empowered. You know, part on some level, I think most survivors who eventually learn about suicide prevention, there's a sense of guilt, like, oh man, if I would have known about this sooner. But the bigger part of it was empowerment. Like, man, we need to be talking about this. I'm going to go to my principal first thing in the morning. And so I took a packet of information. I went to my principal the very next day, and I said, we need to be talking about this. We need to be having conversations about this. And so he kind of, to be honest, kind of blew me off, kind of brushed me off and said, all right, I'll take a look at it. Give me a couple days, come back and we'll talk about it. So I came back a few days later and walked into his office, and he kind of, you know, did the, you know, I got really busy, I'm a principal, come back in a few more days and we'll talk about it. And so we did this dance, honestly, for a few months, until finally one day I walked in and just convinced him. And he's like, you know what, Stan, you're a good kid. I trust you. If you think the other kids here need to learn about this, let's do it. You go raise the money, we'll make it happen. And so I reached out to the San Diego chapter of the Yellow Ribbon Program, and we organized for the founders, Dale and Dar Emmy, to come out to my high school. And as we used to do, and hopefully anybody who works in a school-based setting who listens to this, hopefully this is not what you're still doing, but we gathered all 3,000 students in the gym to have this very intimate conversation about suicide and suicide prevention. And right before they were about to speak, they looked over at me and they said, hey, Stan, have you thought about what you're going to say? And I freaked out. You know, I was like, no way, this is why I did all the work to get you guys here. And I remembered that I had written a poem in memory of my friend Jesse and my writing seminar class. And so I dug it out of my binder and I was like, I'm just going to go with this. And so now here I am, you know, a senior in high school, standing in front of 3,000 students, not just talking about suicide, but reading a freaking poem. And I'm just mortified. Oh. Just like, why did you do this? What were you thinking? This was a horrible idea. What good is ever going to come of this? And so, you know, I survived the presentation. I go home that night, get ready for school the next morning, just preparing for battle, just the onslaught of just ridicule and whatever was going to come from my classmates. And so I'm walking onto campus, and the attendance lady had a window that faced the front of the school so that she could see everybody. And we made eye contact, and she started walking towards me, and I noticed that she had an envelope in her hand. And when she got up close to me, she handed me the envelope, and I remember these words very specifically. She said, I have a gift for you. And so I take the envelope and I open it up, and it's a letter from a girl named Sarah. No last name, no last initial. And basically she goes on in her letter to say that she'd been thinking about suicide, and that for the first time in her life, she's heard somebody talking about the thoughts that she was having in her head. And she shared with me that she was grateful for me sharing the pain of losing my friend Jesse, and grateful for the hope that I shared for other people who are struggling with thoughts of suicide to reach out and get support. And, you know, basically went on saying, thank you for saving my life. And that poem that I was so embarrassed about reading the day before, she told me that her and a bunch of the other kids had actually made copies of it, and it had actually been circulated around campus. And she told me that she posted it next to her bed on the wall, and that she was going to read it every day to remind her of her reasons for living. And
wow,
at that moment, it just shook my world, you know, that it was like, wait, just from a conversation, because here I was, a 17-year-old boy with no background in mental health, no background in suicide prevention, but simply because I was able to say the S word, the word suicide, that it was just that little change of course, you know, just that altering of course for one individual. And so that's what's motivated to dedicate my life to suicide prevention, because I, again, when we speak the name of the beast, it will retreat.
And I just love that image of you feeling like you've just done this horrible thing, and how could you even thought it would make a difference, and then literally you got this gift of gratitude and realized that simple conversations, not mental health professionals, but simple conversations by everyday people can have, you know, I should say not only, mental health professionals definitely do great work, but sometimes it is the simple conversations of everyday people that give people the reason to stay, and even when they don't even know each other. So what a powerful experience to have at such a young age, and it's clearly given you quite a bit of fuel to keep going and growing in all the ways. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what you're seeing now, specifically through the Directing Change program, and then we'll talk about some other things, but I want people to kind of feel like where that moment in time has taken you today, where you're impacting like literally hundreds and thousands of youth every year. So can you talk a little bit about that and kind of what you're seeing now?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really proud of the Directing Change program. The website is directingchangeca.org, but it started off honestly just as just kind of a side project that we thought, you know, maybe we really entered into it hoping that we would maybe get 50 films. It was going to be part of a statewide social marketing campaign to raise awareness around suicide prevention called Know the Signs that we have out here in California. And again, we were hoping for maybe 50. I had the high hope of 100, and my team kind of laughed at me. They're like, there's no way we're going to get 100 films. And really what we did is we went to the safe messaging criteria established from the recommendations for reporting on suicide and the Action Alliance framework on suicide for safe messaging for suicide prevention. And we created a scoring rubric. We had two categories, mental health and suicide prevention, and we, you know, promoted it through every school in California. And at the end of the year, we ended up receiving over 400 films from around the state. And that's what really woke us up. And we're like, oh, wait, this is something that youth are yearning to talk about. You know, we always talk about the percentage of youth who think about suicide or who attempt suicide. But this was, you know, proof, 400 film proof that youth are not just wanting to talk about the issues, that they're wanting to figure out how to prevent their friends from being in so much pain. And so
that was just year one. 400.
Yeah, that was just year one. And so fast forward now, we just completed our 6th year of the program. This year, we received 750 films from around the state. We've also expanded the program a little bit. It was just high school students year one. Now we have a separate category for youth and young adults ages 14 to 25, because we wanted to get those transition age youth an opportunity. We've also kind of lowered the age requirements so that 7th and 8th grade middle school students are also able to participate as well. And we've included other categories. We have a category called Through the Lens of Culture. So we encourage and invite youth to explore suicide prevention, but through the lens of their culture. So in their culture, you know, do their parents talk about mental health and suicide prevention? And we get a number of films in other languages or films that address cultural issues, whether it's issues in the LGBTQ community, in the Native community. So it's just inspiring to see these films and the impact that it has on these youth. And I don't know if you got time for a few other stories, but
of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, anecdotally, you know, we've been evaluated by the NROC at the University of Chicago. And so we have, you know, that version of evaluation, but the anecdotal stories are really what continue to drive me. There was, you know, one young lady who entered the program and she honestly didn't care about the topic. She was just wanting to win $500 and she was a great filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And then she, you know, ended up winning first place statewide in the program and went on into college and became part of her Active Minds chapter, switched her major from filmmaking to psychology, and is now a very passionate advocate for mental health. But one of the stories that really helps remind me of this, of how powerful not just the medium of film can be, but just when we empower youth to have a voice about it. There was a girl the very first year who submitted a film that addressed some issues around mental illness, specifically schizophrenia and such. And the next year she submitted another film and she had my contact information. And over the summertime, I got an email from her and she was reaching out just she needed help. She was having, psychosis was entering her life, and she was having thoughts of suicide. And she reached out to me, and fortunately, I was able to stay on the phone with her for a few hours until we connected her to some crisis support and her family and friends. But it just really brought it home to me that, you know, not only are these youth interested in these topics, that they're struggling, you know, these are things they're dealing with and addressing every single day. And a lot of them don't feel like they have another outlet. You know, they don't feel like they know who to go to in their lives. And so a lot of times we try to protect youth. And I think that's what got us in this mess in the first place, is we were so scared mm-hmm. about talking about suicide. Don't talk about it. You're going to cause it to happen. And it wasn't until we realized, like, they're already talking about it. Let's give them a voice and let's teach them how to talk about it appropriately and safely, and teach them how to include resources and educate their peers about it.
That's what makes me so excited about your model, Stan. It's like the perfect storm of creativity. Like, we always know the arts are such a great place for people to sort this stuff out and to message publicly in a way that's not daunting or intimidating to other people. I love the peer component as well. These are, you know, groups or communities coming together to put this on. And then the competition part really elevates it to leadership and celebratory. I also love the fact that for your award ceremonies, which I'm getting to one of these days, I really want to go. Every time you start talking about it, I'm like, I should be there. I really should be there. You position it not just for kind of elevating the student status, whether that be in Sacramento with your state's, state leaders legislatively, but also, you know, in the Hollywood area with some of our big entertainment voices. Can you talk a little bit about those celebratory experiences and how they benefit not only the youth, but also, you know, these adults of high status that are also leading into this project?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned the awards ceremony, because it's kind of the culmination. I call it kind of a mini Oscars. We bring all the youth down,
exactly.
And, you know, they're wearing their prom dresses and their tuxedos, and it's just an opportunity for us to really give recognition to them, but also, like you said, to bring in some other folks. So the way the program works is we have two rounds of judging. So we have a regional round of judging where, on that level, we have about 200 to 300 judges who are anywhere from mental health professionals, suicide prevention, school folks, community members. And what we're trying to do there is just, you know, obviously we're trying to get the film scored, but we're also trying to introduce a whole new group of people to this concept of safe messaging around suicide prevention, also, you know, effective messaging around mental health. You know, it's not just changing the conversation around suicide prevention, because to do that, you also have to bring in the conversation around mental health and getting people to understand that, you know, it's more than mental illness. And so we engage those folks. So a lot of local reporters, news agencies participate there as well. So we're now introducing them. But on the statewide round, it's great. We get writers, directors, producers. We have Bradley Beaker, who's the executive producer of a show called 911. He was formerly an executive producer and a director on American Horror Story and Glee. And so he's one of our advocates. We've had the directors of a film called It's Kind of a Funny Story that examines kind of the issues of mental health and mental illness from the youth perspective. But a number of writers, producers, you know, casting directors. And the way that I describe it is that, and this is meant with respect, but it's like, how do you give a dog a pill? You hide it in a piece of cheese. You know, if you go to the entertainment folks and you say, hey, I want to educate you on suicide prevention and mental health, I'll be like, yeah, we're good. But if you say, hey, come participate as a judge in this program where these youth are making these amazing films, oh, and by the way, through that process, you're going to learn about appropriate messaging, you know, positive messaging about mental health and suicide prevention. So it's just a great experience all the way around. And we've, this year, as part of our award ceremony, we had Madchen Amik, who is part of the Riverdale show that's really popular among youth, and she's been a really amazing advocate for mental health over the years. So she was one of our guest presenters, as well as Lisa Klein, who directed a film called The S Word that's really brought attention and respect to the attempt survivor community, as well as the lost survivor. So it's been this amazing opportunity, like I said, through the medium of film, to bring all these individuals to a place where they realize it's safe to talk about these topics and to give them the words to talk about it. Because When it comes to messaging, a lot of times, even in my general trainings, whether it's for law enforcement or military school personnel, I always try to start with a conversation about messaging because I feel like if people, until we know what are the right words to use and the right messaging principles to use, we don't always establish a competency, or we're scared to have that conversation. So, you know, I would compare it to, you know, growing up, I wasn't really exposed to people who were in wheelchairs. And one of my good friends in college was had some paralysis, and he was in a wheelchair. And so through that process, I was able to talk to him and say, what's right, what's wrong? And he gave me the words. And from there, we were able to have more competent conversations about some of the issues that he's facing. And so I try to take that mindset into conversations around suicide and suicide prevention, that, you know, until we give people the appropriate words, they're never going to be able to think competently about the topics.
And I will for sure post some of those winning films as well as links to the S word, because from a messaging standpoint, they really knock it out of the park. Can you just highlight for our listeners a little bit, what are some of the core tenets that you focus on when you are teaching people about safe and effective messaging? What are some of the things that you are want to make sure that they've got fully understood?
Yeah, well, I'll go into some of the core pieces, of course, is just the language. You know, when someone dies by suicide, most commonly we hear people refer to it, that person committed suicide. And, you know, just for those listening out there, I'll just, you know, answer in your mind, but, you know, what are some of the other actions that we commit? And I'm guessing that a lot of people are going to, oh, we commit crime, we commit sin, we commit treason and adultery and, you know, all these other negative things. But I'm willing to bet very few people said, oh, well, I commit to my relationship, and I committed to my job, and I committed to my family and my children. And so automatically we're starting in a negative place if we're using that word committed. A lot of people are shocked to find out that it was actually illegal in most states to even attempt suicide up until a few decades ago. And what we're seeing in the faith institutions is that they're starting to change the way they frame suicide, because if I go to my faith leader for a lot of my counseling needs, might I hesitate, or might that create a barrier for me to seek help if I'm having thoughts of suicide, if it's viewed or classified as a sin? Interesting to see individuals, you know, realizing that just how important the words can be. So that's one component of it. Another one is we're trying to get away from the terminology of successful versus an unsuccessful attempt. Because if it's a successful attempt, obviously the person has died. If it was an unsuccessful attempt, the person has lived. And so there's really no success or failure in either one of those scenarios. So I think the baseline knowledge is just getting everybody on the same, you know, same page with wording and terminology.
That's right. And all the other things too that you mentioned earlier about connecting people to resources and, you know, making sure that there's, you know, some kind of narrative of hope or a positive frame. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. I actually want to take you back in time again. Because not only have you helped shape this incredible program for youth to find their voice through the art of filmmaking, but you are also an incredible model for our young people on the power of youth in terms of legislative advocacy. In 2001, you got up before the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Youth and Suicide and testified. And I don't know that youth understand that they have incredible power in these venues. I was part of a Senate hearing this past spring where I got trotted out, you know, as the hat of expert on why the bill that we were trying to pass was so important for the youth of Colorado. And I said, I'm going to keep my remarks short because this guy to my right, this 16-year-old high school student with lived experience, he's going to bring the house down. And sure enough, when he shared his story of experiencing what he did in his suicidal despair and what helped him get to the other side, there was not a dry eye in the room. And we had a very divisive committee. And I can't say we passed the bill, but after his testimony, they at least carried the bill over for some more discussion. So he had a real powerful impact in bringing people together. Can you talk about your experience on what it felt like to be an advocate at the federal level, and then also what you would encourage our young people to do in terms of shaping their voice for legislative advocacy?
Yeah, to be honest with you, at the time, I don't think I understood. You know, I was 19, 20 years old. I don't know that I obviously knew that it was a huge honor to go present and be asked to testify in front of the U.S. Senate subcommittee. But at the time, I don't know that I had enough context for what that might mean. But the experience itself was just overwhelming, and we've actually replicated it with Directing Change and trying to get our youth in front of some legislators. And what I don't think I realized at the time is exactly what you talked about in your experience, is that I think a lot of times with youth, we give them this impression that they're voiceless, that, oh, well, you can't vote, so therefore you don't have any power. And in reality, what I try to communicate to youth, because this is something that I wish I had understood better at the time, was that you actually have more, you know, perhaps more power than you will ever have, because there's such a purity to what you want to see done. You're not doing it for an agenda. You're not doing it for a budget. You're simply doing it because you want to change the world for a better place. And, you know, being up there and being able to testify, you know, looking back, I was able to testify alongside the Surgeon General at the time, David Satcher, who created the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention, Dr. David Jobes, who's one of the leaders in the field from a clinical side on suicide prevention. So again, at the time I was totally clueless as far as how formative of an experience that would be. But looking back, it's really propelled me to help give context to the youth, whether they're accepting an award at Directing Change, or they're meeting with a local legislator, or they're just sharing their story with their peers, to just help them understand that you have so much power and you have so much ability right now. And that, you know, don't let society change you to think that you can't make an impact, because they really can have so much ability for change.
Thanks. I think we could do a lot more of that. And really, you know, as you said, it's so raw. They don't have another agenda. And because of that real raw, close to their personal experience voices, you really can't get much powerful than that. Let's share us a little bit about you know, kind of your understanding of the science behind the importance of safe messaging. Why do we care about it so much? Why is it more than just political correctness, or more than just the language, the words that we use? Why are we, the suicide prevention community, so intense about the importance of safe and effective messaging?
Well, I think part of it is we just have to give respect to media, to both news media, entertainment media, and realize how big of a platform they have and how much people can be influenced by them. And one of the key components that I try to come into any of my work around communications, whether it's in the entertainment world or in the news world, is coming to them as partners in suicide prevention. I think a lot of times in the suicide prevention community, we come with our pitchforks in tow and we're ready to, you know, how could you not know this? How dare you? And I think when we step back and realize, if we come to these individuals as partners, if we come to our local broadcasting, you know, news agency and say, hey, you know, if you did this, you know, we could save some lives together, as opposed to you go up to anybody and you say, hey, don't do this or you might kill somebody, everybody's going to freak out. And again, we start to take away that competency. But if we come to them as partners and say, hey, here's some things you might not be aware of, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job, but will you partner with us? You know, you are also community members. They are also survivors of attempts and survivors of suicide loss. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not a core competency about how we message around suicide, especially in the news media. And so I think first we have to give power and respect to the voice that they have, but also I think we need to acknowledge that they are also community members. They are also people living in our neighborhoods. And of course they would want to make a difference. If they could help, you know, if they could help steer the ship over to somebody thinking about living instead of dying, then why wouldn't they want to help? And so I think we also have to come to them with some reasons behind it, that this isn't just stuff we're saying because we're saying it, you know, that these are national consensus and this is based on research. And it's the simple things, you know, you alluded to it earlier about, you know, including a resource, just acknowledging that, you know, anytime we talk about suicide, suicide prevention, mental health, knowing how many people have been affected by those issues, that, yeah, it's going to bring some emotions to the surface to some people. And let's help guide them to the right direction. One of the things that I really work a lot towards in getting people to understand is, you know, I really frown upon, for a long time when I was working in the very few years at the beginning of suicide prevention, we were just screaming from the rooftops trying to get people to realize there was an issue. You know, there's a fire over here, everybody pay attention. And so we were saying things like, every 17 minutes somebody dies and every 40 seconds somebody attempts. And although that might be useful if you're going to somebody to try to get some funding, you know, you take a step back and it's not even accurate, really. It's not like a suicide is happening on time every 17 minutes, that we were distorting statistics to try to make them more dramatic. But we've come to a place in our society now where, you know, we did a survey through our Know the Science campaign here in California and asked people, and people acknowledge they don't need to be convinced that suicide's an issue anymore. They need to be told what to do about it. So if we're focusing on statistics that just, you know, try to scare people straight, we're not teaching them anything. And so rather than using those types of statistics, you know, in California, for example, we point to, hey, last year over 200,000 calls to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline came from California. So rather than normalizing suicide behavior, let's normalize help-seeking behavior. Let's acknowledge that there's a lot of us who are struggling and a lot of us don't know what resources are out there, or that help is just, you know, literally a phone call away. So I think those are a few of the key components. There's some others that we try to educate folks on, you know, try to avoid descriptions of means and methods. You know, I remember when Jesse died that, and I'm not sure if you got this a lot with your brother, but, you know, a lot of people would ask me, oh, well, how did he die? Like in what manner, what method did he use? And immediately that question would just make me think of how he did it. You know, I would get that image in my brain immediately and it would just suck all the life out of me. And so, you know, it's an acknowledgement that that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that there was somebody who was in so much pain that they chose to not want to live. And I think this gets into some other kind of principles that I share when I'm messaging around suicide, that, and these have been coming up more and more in the suicide prevention field, but, you know, suicide prevention is not about convincing somebody not to die. It's about reminding somebody of their reasons to live. And so when I'm doing a training or I'm talking, you know, even a general training, let's say, for example, you come up to me, even as a suicide prevention expert, and you say, hey, Stan, can you go over there and prevent that person from dying by suicide? That would sound overwhelming even to me. But if you came to me and you said, hey, Stan, can you go over there and help that person, you know, reduce their pain a little bit? Or could you go over there and help that person increase their hope a little bit? Could you go over there and help that person remember some reasons for living? I think any of us could say, yeah, after, you know, I'll give it a shot. But when we use that term prevent suicide, it sounds so dramatic and so drastic. Like, well, how could I even do that? And so a lot of what I try to do is help people understand that, for one, you know, thoughts of suicide, suicidality, whatever you want to call it, it's an enormous spectrum. And not everybody that's having thoughts of suicide can be put in the same bucket. But I really try to convince people and communicate to people that, you know, when you reduce suicide down to its two most basic components, in my opinion, it comes down to pain and hope. And I believe that, you know, most suicides happen when pain outweighs hope. And it's not, you know, it took me a while to understand that when my friend Jesse or when people who are thinking about suicide, that it's not that they want to die, it's that they don't know how to go on living with that pain. But pain and hope are something that we have access to in the people in our lives. You know, we can impact their pain. We can't reduce all of it. We can't inject them with overwhelming hope, but we can absolutely have an impact on it. So I think when we simplify suicide down, you know, I tell people in my trainings, you know, what, don't worry about, it's not bullying, it's not breakups, it's not mental illness, it's not being a veteran or this, that, or the other thing. It's about pain. And I think pain is universal. And when we bring it to a concept that we all can understand, I think it makes it more approachable.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that is where it's at. It's really about, you know, how do we empower the everyday people to not be afraid of this, but to realize that everybody's had a lived experience with misery or isolation, or feeling left out, or feeling like a failure, and how do we tap into that to connect some way with ourselves in terms of our humanity with one another, to really help share the load of that pain, if you will, or to find that little flicker of flame that's inside someone that is keeping them here, and really listening to it and helping that grow. What other things have you learned from your youth? What have they taught you through this process? How have they inspired you? What are some of the places you see this growing?
Well, I think for one, you know, I think millennials and the generations below, they get a lot of grief. Oh, you know, what good are they going to do? And how are they, you know, you know, there's just people who think there's so much complacency in that generation. And for me, I'm like, when I hear that, I'm like, man, you got to come hang out with the kids that I work with, because these kids are going to change the world. So the thing that I take away the most from them is that they're not scared of the topics. They're not scared of mental health. They're not scared of suicide and suicide prevention. They want to. They realize that these are issues, and their sense of empathy is just amazing. You know, what I love about youth is that, you know, for me, I had to be impacted by suicide, even though it happened at a young age, for me to open my eyes to it. And so many of the youth that I work with through Directing Change or any of the other programs I do, they don't want to have a story. They realize, they're like, oh, yep. Wait, so if I learn this and I talk about this, I don't have to have a story of losing somebody that I love to suicide. And they realize how many other people are struggling. And so they're just so much more proactive, and they don't, you know, as we get older, we start to, you know, look at all the barriers. Oh, how can we possibly change this? And what possible impact can we have? And the youth that I work with are just fearless. You know, they are just full of pride, and they say, well, I'm not going to accept that we can't change this. I'm not going to accept that this is just the way things are, and therefore that's the way that things have to be. So for me, working with them is just absolutely inspiring every day to see them step forward and to see that change in them, you know, from becoming just, you know, this high school student who's kind of passionate to them creating this film, and now their film is on a website and it's being showed on the big screen at the awards ceremony, and people are downloading it tens of thousands of times, and it's being utilized in presentations across the state and across the country. And they're like, oh, wow, just from a 60-second film that I created, there's all these other people who are finding the words to talk about suicide. You know, we prompt them in their film, you know, don't just talk about what you want people to do, show them what you want them to do, demonstrate what it looks like to have a friend supporting a friend, not just recognizing the warning signs, but acting, show them what that conversation looks like. And we also encourage them, as much as from a messaging standpoint, we tell people not to oversimplify the causes of suicide. We don't want to oversimplify the ways that we prevent it or help people remind of their reasons to live. So it's more than a simple act of kindness. It's being, you know, that sustained support, you know, being there day after day and checking in and having the conversation and, you know, making, even though of course suicide is a big deal, talking about suicide does not have to be a big deal. And so for them, that's what I see. They're like, oh, suicide's a problem. Let's talk about suicide prevention. Let's jump in. Let's get our hands dirty.
Let me just underscore what a really important moment this is in the movement of suicide prevention, because when you think about it, when you look back, it really was the people most directly impacted, usually the suicide loss survivors at first, and then later the suicide attempt survivors that came out and talked about, you know, waving our flags, like, pay attention, this is really important. But I think about, like, the breast cancer movement, right? It also started in a similar way. Families that were immediately impacted were the voices that were shouting out. And then all of a sudden it was the people recovering from it that became our cultural heroes. And then the science told us about things that we could do to save people's lives. And now all of a sudden, you know, you've got NFL players wearing pink cleats, and, you know, all kinds of people who have not been personally affected by breast cancer are standing up and saying, you know what, this matters to our community. And I think what you're just saying right there about the youth saying, I don't want a story, I want to be part of the solution, is kind of a really important tipping point in our movement, that you don't have to be personally impacted to make a huge difference here. And for them to experience that firsthand, to see that their effort is impacting all of these people. We talk about, you know, the contagion of suicide and how scary that is. Well, there's also this contagion of hope that Kevin Hines talks about, that, you know, you can spread hope just even more powerfully and quickly sometimes, by showing, by demonstrating these inspiring messages and these inspiring stories of recovery and resilience and empathy and compassion. All of these can spread and really change a culture. Where are you headed? What are some things on your horizon as you think forward about where you're going? What's exciting you in the next few months or years?
You know, we're going to keep Directing Change going, of course. We're looking to expand the program and give more opportunities across the country, hopefully to new states and new regions, to give more youth a voice, because as dynamic and diverse as California is, there's a bunch of other stories out there that need to be told and need to be shared. For me, I'm really jumping in deep with, I've been doing a lot of presentations with the military and the Navy
as well as with first responders, EMS, and law enforcement. And then, you know, we talk about the numbers of veteran suicide and military suicide, but I was able to have, you know, a real conversation with leaderships, admirals, commanders, captains the other day, and basically told them, look, you know, if we're going to keep pressing the red button every time somebody talks about suicide and sending them away, people aren't going to stop having thoughts of suicide. They're just going to stop talking about thoughts of suicide, and we're just going to keep doing the same dance. And it was, you know, one of the first times I think that they'd heard somebody just be real with them. So I'm really excited about that. Working with the military, I think there's a lot of changes that we can do there to support our active duty, our service members, as well as our veterans, as well as in law enforcement, first responders. I think what we're doing is we're missing the mark. We think that everybody who's suicidal is going to show up as suicidal, and helping them to understand that we're, you know, whether they're responding to a call about domestic violence or an illness, that there still could be cause for asking about suicide, because we're missing so many people that are just below the surface when it comes to these issues. So over the next few years doing that, and then really excited to continue my work with media. You know, a lot of suicide prevention has kind of been in the abstract or through research. And so one of the things that I'm blessed with through all my contracts is I get to take all the amazing work of people like Dr. Madeline Gould, and I get to put it into practice. So here in San Diego, we have a media plan. We're going to be connecting with each of our major news networks and giving them trainings on safe and effective messaging for suicide prevention, and really hitting that critical mass is what I'm hoping for.
Can you talk a little bit more so our listeners know what the work of Madeline Gould is all about? Can you share some of her findings and how that's affecting what you're trying to implement?
Yeah, you know, one of her first research studies was one of the most basic ones. You know, she went in and she, you know, proved that talking about suicide doesn't increase risk of suicide, which was one of the first studies that really stopped the shame and stopped the stigma around it. She's done a lot of research around contagion around suicide and suicide clusters as well. And so she's my superhero. I mean, almost everything I do is based on her work in some shape or form. And I think, you know, having the honor to meet her a few months back, I think it's because she brings so much humanity to it. You know, one of the things we were at the, well, you were there, the American Association of Suicidology, we were at the conference this year. And one of the takeaways, I was kind of disheartened from the conferences, because in so many of the presentations we talked about, suicide prevention is stuck, it's not working, we're doing all this work, but the numbers are going up, and, you know, kind of the sky is falling mentality. And, you know, I kind of took a step back and said, no, look, we haven't hit critical mass yet. You know, here in California, we're blessed. We have the Mental Health Services Act, Prop 63, where we're able to take a lot of that amazing research, but we're able to put it into practice. You know, there's a lot of communities across the country that are doing, you know, one part or two parts. But when you look at some of the bigger strategic documents, like the CDC released a technical package, the National Action Alliance released Transforming Communities, the SPRC, Suicide Prevention Resource Center, has the strategic framework. And there's really not very many communities out there who are firing on all cylinders and addressing suicide as a public health issue. And I think what we've done is we've actually done a disservice to suicide prevention by mystifying it, you know, by making it only in the hands of a special few specific mental health professionals can we ever prevent suicide. And we created this mentality that, okay, all we have to do is we identify who's at risk, and we pass them along, and at the end of this linking chain there will be a magic leprechaun who cures suicide. And we didn't ever realize that leprechaun doesn't exist, and that,
right,
you know, again, you know, it's in the power of the people, that the cop who responds to that, to the scene, you know, the more compassion and empathy that they can show, and the more that they can be competent in their decision making about, does this person need to go to the hospital, or can this be a more moderate referral? The teacher at the school who is more comfortable having a conversation around suicide and then waiting to refer to the counselor. You know, the faith leader who is more comfortable with their ability to inject some hope and reduce some pain. And then also, you know, from a community level, having our public leaders, you know, get behind strategic documents. Like in California, we're in the process of updating our statewide plan. And in San Diego, we're one of five or six counties across the state that actually have a strategic plan for suicide prevention. We just updated it and released it last month. You know, getting people to understand, we've talked for a long time in the suicide prevention community and said that everyone has a role in suicide prevention, but we forgot step two, which is you got to tell people what their role is. And we're finally figuring out that.
I was going to say, not to shame them for doing it wrong. You know, we're really good at that, shaming people for doing it wrong. Oh, you got, you know, you're doing it all wrong. And then people are like, whoops, I guess I shouldn't try to talk about it. But, you know, like you said, coach them, give them tips, give them direction on how to get engaged. Absolutely.
Yeah, and also realize it's not perfect science. You know, the national strategy came out, what, 17 years ago? We have only been really digging our hands into the dirt on this one for, you know, not even two decades now. And not everything is going to be hard science. Not everything is going to be perfect. And sometimes, you know, we have to be creative. You know, one example is that we talk about means restriction, reducing access to lethal means and what that looks like. And, you know, I have a friend, a colleague of mine who was working with a military member who absolutely would not let the firearm be taken out of his home. He simply wouldn't let it happen. And so she got creative and she said, well, where do you keep the gun? And he said, well, I keep it in my nightstand. And she said, okay, last time you were going to attempt suicide, obviously something stopped you. What stopped you? And he said, I thought about my daughter. And she said, okay, this is what I want you to do when you get home. I want you to take your favorite picture of your daughter and I want you to put it on top of that gun. And if you ever go to make an attempt again, you physically have to move your daughter out of the way before you can reach for the gun. And he said that saved his life at least 10 times. So sometimes we have to just work in the moment. What is this person's situation? What are they willing to do? What are they not willing to do? And, you know, acknowledge that the only person who's going to decide whether or not someone dies by suicide is that person. So rather than taking the power away from them, we need to empower them more and give them option B and option C and option D and help them. Again, it starts with understanding the pain, building that rapport, building that resiliency, and then moving on from there.
Well, thanks so much, Stan. What a wonderful way to wrap up the conversation. I'm going to go through and kind of hit a couple of the highlights of some of the things that you've been sharing with us, and then we're going to come back to you. And what I would like is if you could share your final thoughts with us on if there's a young person out there that feels moved to get involved in the efforts of suicide prevention and or share a story of that they're hoping might make a difference, what are some first steps that that young person or their family or their teachers or whoever's coaching them, what are some first steps that they might take in that effort to avoid some pitfalls and create the, you know, the biggest impact for that endeavor? So let me go back. So we started off with your very poignant and powerful story about Jesse, and you were so young, at just 14 years old. I think, you know, there's many people that have at some point in their life this before and after moment that kind of demarks their life, and for you to have it so young has really been a powerful marker in kind of the person that you've grown to be. And I'm so grateful that Sarah's letter came along shortly thereafter to really fuel your passion for this, because you've done so much good work, not just for youth, although that's been a big part of your heart and a big part of your effort, but really in the nation of challenging our thinking, especially around how we talk about this stuff. I love directing change, and I can't wait to bring it to Colorado and help you figure out a way to scale it nationally, because I think it's a perfect model of, again, creating this opportunity for creativity, lifting up the voices of youth, having peers be involved in a very proactive, positive project around something that adults find so daunting, and really coaching them not just to be successful, but to be celebrated at a very, very high level. The fact that you can teach them safe and effective messaging without squelching their creativity is perfect balance of what we need. You were spot on when you talk about the power of the voice of the youth in its purity, in its fearlessness, in its empathy. They are in a position to really change how we view things and really create cultures of caring for one another. I also loved your point about let's see the media as partners. We're not going to get through this issue of reporting on suicide if we keep blaming them and shaming them for doing it wrong, criticizing everything they do. They're in the business of telling the news, and so sometimes suicide is newsworthy. And so can we come up alongside them and say, hey, I'm here to help you as a subject matter expert or someone who knows a couple of things about this. How can I help you do this story so that we can potentially increase the likelihood that people find their way through their suicide crises. I've listed off a number of the best practices that you offered throughout the talk today. Number one, offer resources, whatever we're messaging publicly about suicide, and make sure those resources are vetted well and accessible by your community. Let's focus on positive social norms when we're talking about statistics. So instead of drumming the beat of the death data over and over again, let's create the positive social norms of help seeking and empathy and reaching out, the kinds of things we want to see more of. Very important to avoid the description of means, methods, and also place. And I like how you put it, that is not the point of the story. And that's really more about kind of this voyeuristic sensationalism that doesn't add anything to the story other than, you know, some gratuitous details. Let's talk about the messaging about reconnecting for reasons to live. Have it come from the person and have our messaging gently guide them back to that place of why they're here. And also, let's not forget that the pain is real and acknowledging that misery and finding ways to work around it. And finally, your last best practice, let's not oversimplify the causes of suicide, but let's also not oversimplify the recovery and the healing process. There are trials and tribulations, and a lot of times people need to try a bunch of different stuff on before they figure out what actually works for them. So what a great conversation to have. And our landing page will be chock full of resources and examples of what this looks like, not just for youth, but for all those who are trying to figure out ways to talk about suicide publicly. So Stan, coming back to you, what are some final thoughts you have maybe for a young person who might want to be a positive messenger around this? Where should they start and how might they avoid some pitfalls?
Well, first, I think it starts with not underestimating the role that you can have in helping somebody remember their reasons for living, regardless of your role, whether it's a family member, a friend. You know, start and realize that for as much as we need mental health professionals and high-level people, what we need, the most important conversations we're going to have around suicide and suicide prevention are with our friends and our family. So start there. You know, get educated about the basics, look at some of the big picture items, the national strategy and some of those leading documents, and then go ask. Hold people accountable. Go, you know, for the young person out there, go to your school and say, hey, do we have policies around suicide prevention? What are our policies around suicide prevention? And participate, you know, offer your opinion. But, you know, one of the things that I want to acknowledge in the suicide prevention community is that a lot of times we're looking for evidence-based and best practices. And, you know, this has been proven to work, so it's going to work in your community. But when you go to a lot of these, you know, leading organizations and the conferences, it's a lot of old white men, you know, and the lack of diversity is obviously apparent. So if something, when you're out there and you're seeking and, you know, for youth, you know, if something doesn't feel like it's going to fit, you know, then create something new. Get some smart people together that know their stuff and say, hey, this isn't going to work for us. We need to make something that's going to work for my community, for my friends and my family. So I would start by paying attention to what's out there. But again, don't underestimate not just the role you can have in individuals, but the role that you can have in changing the paradigm and changing the conversations.
Boom. That's it. That's exactly it. Thank you, Stan. I love this. This was so great. And thanks for being such an amazing champion for all of us and such a good friend and mentor and colleague of mine. I love this interview, and I hope you enjoyed yourself. Where can people find you if they want to learn more?
They can find me through the Directing Change website, directingchangeca.org, or at Stan P. Collins on Twitter.
Excellent. All right. So hopefully everybody listening, thanks for joining us today and tuning into this really important conversation. For more episodes, please subscribe to our iTunes channel, the Hope Illuminated Podcast, or you can go to my website, sallyspencerthomas.com, and sign up for the newsletter so you can get a sense of all the cool things that are coming up. We've got Twitter chats and webinars and all kinds of good stuff. So join us. So in closing,
thanks,
I want you all to open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.